So welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. And joining me from New York is Rafat Ali. How are you doing, Rafat?
Hey, Mark. Good. Just now that November and December is coming and only literally 2 weeks left before things start to trail off, we're just jamming through a lot of stuff on the startup side.
Yeah, so one of the things that I guess there's been a lot of news happening lately. I mean, one of the things is, I guess is probably the most unsurprising news ever, that News Corp, their tablet-only publication, The Daily, shut down. It's something that I know we've both been a little skeptical about.
Yeah, I mean, it was the most obvious, shocking news of 2012. That they were shut down. I just never understood why they just launched an iPad and not even an iPhone version when, if their whole point was snack, I think you and I talked about it like five times over the last year.
Probably, yeah.
Their whole philosophy about the web later, which they changed completely, or at least tried to. But why not have an iPhone version along with iPad? Because if it was snackable, in transit kind of readership that they wanted to get, then surely iPad wasn't it.
Yeah, and it just seems like, the people there might have been really good, but they just had a very, pretty heavy editorial footprint. I mean, a lot of people to try to put out something, for an iPad. I mean, I think... like you said, they're pretty high quality people that were there editorially, but if you're going to try to do something kind of lightweight and iPad or mobile friendly, it seems like you'd have a much smaller staff than that.
Yeah, I mean, even Circa, which you and I have been, or at least I have been a little skeptical on.
Yeah.
Has at least, firstly, it's lean. I mean, it's not lean, but it's certainly lean, much, much leaner than The Daily, and just seems to, even if it fails as an experiment, well, I mean, it just was not that much invested in it. So it just seems a better way to look at it than what the Daily did. So it'll be interesting to see what this. So Circa, by the way, just 2 days ago, launched a web version of it.
Yeah.
App, which. I don't know if they learned directly from the Daily, but it just seems a lot more logical instead of boxing it. And especially in a news environment, trying to box it on one platform just seems completely backward.
Yeah, I mean, this is a day and age of multi-platforms and getting your news out however you can, whether it's, online, on mobile, tablet, smartphone, social media. I mean, there shouldn't be a limit to what you're doing when you're putting out news and information. And, it's funny to contrast the idea of a launch, a media news launch in this day and age, because the contrast is so big when you look at, let's say, a News Corp or a kind of traditional media. The way they want to launch, let's say, a new magazine or a new publication is, let's hire, 100 people, let's put millions of dollars into it, let's make it splashy, let's have parties. And then you have a smaller kind of new startup. I mean, it's not an exact analogy, but what you're doing or what Circa is doing, or this kind of the Silicon Valley idea, is let's get a few people together and start small and just build it up and scale it up, not start with the huge scale.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't going to give my example myself, but
but I can do it for you.
Yeah. Yeah, we're five people. I tweeted, Facebooked it 2 days ago in a very respectful way, saying that Skift is beating USA Today Travel, which is the sort of default travel news site out there. It's probably the largest out of all the outside of the portal world. It's like the largest travel content site. And because of USA Today's historical roots in the travel industry, in the hotel and all this other stuff. We're beating them on every story that matters in the travel industry with a staff of three editorial people versus theirs 15 to 16 to 17. So it
Yeah,
just.
and that's the history of what you did as one person to paid content, and what a lot of people have done as either bloggers or just kind of starting out, and or like Brian Stelter with TV Newser. You know, it's like one person can beat a large organization. You know, large isn't necessarily always better.
Yeah, I think that's really the lesson that if daily, however, 50 million they invested, 30, 50, whatever, pick a number, could have spread out among startups that were trying to do different things, even like 1/10 each to different 10 startups. It would have been probably been worth the effort. But anyway, you got to give them Mars for trying. Murdoch is the only one investing in news right now. So.
Yeah, and we ran a story about the Daily saying, you know, that hey, they did learn a lot. You know, for what they got, it was like a you know, like an R&D lab of sorts for News Corp, and they obviously must have picked up a lot about, you know, tablet journalism.
Yeah, for whatever that's worth, but yes, R&D, R&D lab, yes.
And speaking of labs and science, we have a very science-heavy show today. We'll be talking about drones possibly coming to journalism and their use by for either good or possibly for evil by kind of paparazzi. You know, will we have drone use by journalists? And then we'll talk to the head of NASA.gov, the NASA space site. Is undergoing a big revamp and redesign, but they're also taking into account what their readers and what the people who visit their site have to say, and they're doing a very kind of interesting, innovative way of doing the redesign. So we'll talk to Brian Dunbar, who's the head of NASA.gov.
Their site, by the way, was down last night because they released these amazing images. I don't know if you saw
This light night
light,
light video.
yeah, Earth at night images, and we took two just because they were sort of, and space tourism is a growing subject, so we did a story on it. But their site was down probably because of that heavy traffic for that. It was just amazing images and
Yeah.
huge in terms of the file sizes.
This is famous minor television personality John Hodgman. You're listening to The Media Twits with Mark Glazer and Rafat Ali.
So first let's turn to drones and whether they're coming to journalism. There was a rumor that gossip site TMZ was going to use drones to follow celebrities. That turned out to be false, but the truth is that drones could be used by journalists to cover disasters or get overhead views of important events. The Daily used one to capture hurricane damage. And what's in store for drones in journalism? Joining us is Matt Waite, professor of practice at the College of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, the founder of the Drone Journalism Lab. Formerly, he was senior news technologist at the St. Petersburg Times, now called the Tampa Bay Times, where he developed the Pulitzer Prize-winning PolitiFact site. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thank you.
We also have Katie Culver, who's assistant professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication and associate director of the Center for Journalism Ethics. Culver focuses on the ethical dimensions of social tools, technological advances, and networked information. She also serves as visiting faculty at the Poynter Institute. Welcome, Katie.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
So, Matt, first of all, tell us about the drone journalism lab that you have at Nebraska. For a lot of journalists, you know, it's kind of surprising to think that drones or these unmanned aerial vehicles will have a place in practice. What made you decide to do this?
Well, I was at a digital mapping conference last year in California, and it was this huge software conference that had all of these government, military, oil and gas industry, all kinds of different people who use digital mapping to do their business. And there's 20,000 people at this conference, so it's massive, and the vendor floor is gigantic. And I was walking through it, looking at all these neat technologies, and I stopped by a booth for a company called Gatewing, and they were selling a product called the X100, and it was a fully autonomous aerial mapping platform. You just told it, I want to photograph this field, and you told it where you were going to take off from and where you wanted it to land, and off it went and did it. No pilot required or anything. And I'm watching this product demo video, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, there's every hurricane I ever covered. There's the tornadoes in Joplin, Missouri, and Tuscaloosa, Alabama. So I ran up to the guy on the sales floor and just handed him my wallet and said, I'll take that one. And he kind of laughed, gave me my wallet back, and he said, well, they're about $65,000 each. And by the way, they're completely illegal in the United States, at least right now. And not willing to let the idea die, I went back and started looking into it, and I realized that the FAA was changing the rules when it came to commercial uses of unmanned vehicles to do things like journalism. And because of the costs involved, I put two and two together and realized that this could be a thing. The opportunities to do things that journalists already do. I should hasten to point this out. Journalists have been using helicopters and airplanes and things like that for many years. With reduced newsroom budgets, the idea of journalists just hopping into a helicopter anytime they want to is pretty much gone. But UAVs and the costs involved suddenly put that back on the table and expand the kind of data and information, video and photos that journalists can gather. And so that's kind of where it all started, and started seeking some grant funds to fund research. And we managed to get one from the Knight Foundation to start doing this, and have really only started getting rolling. I wish you could see my desk right now. It's kind of a disaster zone of quad rotors and soldering irons and multimedia meters and things like that.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So tell us about the project. You did a project recently looking at kind of the Nebraska drought and what's going on there. And it was kind of, I guess, a test case for you guys.
Yeah, here in Nebraska, we're going through the worst drought since the Dust Bowl era of the 1930s. And, you know, signs of that drought are everywhere. You don't need to go very far to see dead trees, dead lawns, things like that. But there's another lab here on campus called the Nimbus Lab over in Computer Science and Engineering, and they're studying the computer science questions involved in using UAVs. And they heard about us, and I've been over there many times, and we've started collaborating on things, but they offered to go out with one of their vehicles and do something for a story, so long as we could kind of fit it into a narrow window of FAA regulations, we could do it. And so we came up with doing a story about the drought, and we went out on a river here in the state, the Platte River, that is a major water supply it runs right through the middle of the state, and it has a very widely varying kind of hydrological setup. The joke around the state is that the Platte River is a mile wide and an inch deep. So it does go dry at various points throughout the year, but this summer it was exceptionally dry. In fact, there was almost no water in it between late June and through September. So going out and getting aerial video of a dry river, of a river with no water in it, was visually interesting and also newsworthy. And so we could do it in very rural places, far from airports, far from people, and do it safely. And that's what we ended up doing.
So, Katie, you wrote a really great story, I thought, for Media Shift about kind of the ethical dilemmas around drones. Obviously, what Matt's talking about is something that seems pretty simple. It's serving a journalism function. But what do you think there could be problems if kind of drones proliferate?
Well, I think there are a number of ethical concerns that come right to the top of mind. And I've been interviewing some of the people who are most interested in working on this. And I think it's fascinating that a lot of them are based at universities. It's this great public-private partnership model. It's, I think it holds a lot of promise for us. But certainly safety. You know, Matt, all those rotors that he has laying across his desk, once they're put in the air, they do pose a safety problem for people. And I should also mention that a lot of these are legal and ethical concerns that very quickly become entangled. Beyond that, I think civil libertarians are very concerned about conflicts of interest, about media acting as surrogates for police. The biggest attention being paid to drones over in U.S. airspace right now is law enforcement agencies using them and whether they have to have a warrant. And the presidents there actually really do favor law enforcement, that, you know, once you're in the national airspace, the presumption of privacy on private property becomes murky at best. I also think, you know, Matt was talking about being able to get sophisticated geolocation and orthographically corrected, I'm sorry, that's probably a little too techy, images. But I also think there's a question of accuracy and context. And you could use, for instance, a drone above a crowd to do a crowd count at a protest, but you don't have the context on same context as on the ground about who's saying what, you know, which sides are involved in the protest, what's the level of violence on the ground, that kind of thing. So I think there quite useful tools, and I know Matt and a couple of people working on this at Illinois, including Matt Schroyer, would say absolutely drones are not the answer to be used on their own. They have to be used with other tools. So accuracy and context are things that we should pay attention to. But definitely, far and away, the big kahuna is privacy. Privacy is the biggest concern of all, and I think we're going to see ethics playing a very important role in our discussions because the law simply has not caught up to where we are technologically.
This is Rafa. I think that besides U.S., and I know what you talked about U.S., I mean, this seems to have a lot more implications in all good and bad ways. Just the mind boggles at thinking about it. Outside U.S., mainly in conflict zones and war zones, and I'm guessing some news organizations at some point have already tried it. But the ethics of U.S. companies, media companies, using it in war zones and other countries, what do you think of that? Does it make any difference?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's very similar to other technological challenges we've faced when we become a borderless information society. So the cultural norms and laws that are within the U.S. borders differ significantly from other countries. And so when U.S. news organizations try to go into airspace in other countries, there's a whole different set of ethical considerations, a whole different set of legal considerations, and we have to be mindful of that. Most of the people that I've talked to so far based in the U.S. are really interested solely in U.S. uses right now, in sort of navigating our own space before figuring out going into other spaces. But Matt may know of other international uses. I've read of ones in Russia and maybe a few other spots in the what was the Eastern Bloc. So I don't know that any U.S. news organizations are thinking internationally right now. Matt, do you know of any?
No, the other more recent example is a protest in Argentina where a judge actually shut down the airspace and activists were able to hack together a quadcopter and get a camera in the air and provide evidence of just how widespread the protest was. It's kind of a broader point to this discussion of international and particularly in conflict zones. One of the things that really excites me about this and also kind of comforts me is that a lot of times the questions that we have about using UAVs to do this boil down to be not terribly complicated. They tend to be issues like gravity. Safety is an issue when it crashes. And what's going to happen when it crashes? Well, it's pretty simple. A piece of hardware is going to fall on somebody's head. There's not a lot of ambiguity here. With using it in conflict zones, particularly if you were trying to cover, let's say for a moment, you're in Syria and you're trying to cover the Syrian opposition to Bashar al-Assad, militaries have developed technologies for decades on being able to target electronic signals. So if you are standing at a house with a remote control device and you are broadcasting a radio signal that ties you to a spot, it's a fairly trivial technological matter to then target artillery on you. And flying an aircraft in a combat zone, last time I checked, they're not going to be terribly concerned about whether or not you are a combatant or not. You have a surveillance aircraft in the air. So I think that before journalists think about using these things in conflict zones, there's a whole other level of thinking that goes on, and that is, are you provoking the situation more than you maybe should? Are you involving yourself in a situation to a dangerous level? Are you exposing yourself to danger by using these things? And these are all, you know, issues we really haven't had to think about, and it's exciting and a little bit scary all at the same time.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe it makes more sense to not send them into a real hot zone where there's war, let's say, or something actively going on, but maybe after the fact to kind of check out the damage and things like that, there might be a possibility, or maybe a way to even have part of the airspace for, you know, kind of neutral parties like NGOs or the UN or press or something, so that it's an area that, you know, you shouldn't shoot them down or something like that.
Right. But I mean, then you have examples in Africa with ethnic conflict and kind of asymmetric warfare where they're, you know, who's on what side, and is there a functioning government to regulate the airspace? And, you know, these journalists all the time have to make very serious decisions about their own personal safety moving in situations like that, and traveling from one town to another and trying to cover those stories when you have kind of fluid situations. Using a UAV, I think, amps that up several levels.
Definitely. Well, thanks a lot for joining us. Really appreciate your insight.
No problem.
Well, thanks, Katie, for joining us.
It was quite enjoyable. Thanks.
So now let's turn to NASA redesigning its website with public input. For the first time since 2007, the award-winning U.S. space site, NASA.gov, will be redesigning its web presence. But they're not just making their redesign in private, but opening it up for the public to submit and vote on the best ideas, all over at an IdeaScale forum. Joining us is Brian Dunbar, who's managed the NASA.gov website since 1995. The site is one of the most popular across the government and is periodically named one of the best on the web, most recently this year by Time Magazine. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about just the web presence. Give us, I mean, you've been there for a while. I mean, you've really been there since kind of the nascent part of the web. How has the web presence at NASA kind of changed over the years?
Well, it's obviously changed very dramatically. I've been doing this since 1995, back in the days of server-side image maps and 14.4 modems. And obviously the main thing that's changed is the interactivity. And trying to bring more of an immediate feel to what we're doing. When we started out, we were pretty much an online newspaper. We were publishing images. We were publishing text. We weren't even publishing a lot of videos because there wasn't much demand for them in the days when most people didn't have broadband. And so now we're very much a very video-heavy site, an interactive feature site focusing on that, and also live events that we webcast. NASA has its own television service, which provides you with the shots, say, of inside mission control and all the press conferences that we do. And so when we have an event, we put it out over the TV service, primarily for news media, but then we stream it over the web. When Curiosity landed in August, we had at landing, we had 1.2 million people, or 1.2 million webcasts going out for people who were following it online.
Yeah, that's amazing. What do you think? I mean, it seems like you guys have had this very popular web presence over the years, and I guess it spikes when it comes to these events. I mean, is that what you have to kind of deal with, is scaling to deal with these very big events where just tons of people come to check it out?
Yes, we've been doing that since even before I started working on it in 1994. If you remember when Comet Shoemaker-Levy collided with Jupiter, we thought it would be cool to use this internet thing as a new way to communicate with people. And so we let them know that we would be posting pictures of the comet's collision as we, not quite as we got them, but with a minimal amount of processing. And the event happened in the overnight Eastern U.S. time. And we planned to publish the pictures, post the pictures the next morning. And of course, what we found, which won't surprise anybody from this perspective, is that people knew when we were going to get the pictures, and they were banging on our servers at 1 o'clock in the morning, expecting, have you posted them now? How about now? And it's just gone like that through the first, the Mars Sojourner landing in 1997. When we learned a lot about separating our internet, public internet facing sites away from our institutional networks, because it became impossible in this building to send an email that afternoon. And so
wow.
Progress has just gone on and on and on like that, especially then in the last, you know, 7 or 8 years, as broadband has become the de facto standard for U.S. customers, and then in other parts of the world, as people are just wanting more and more.
So tell us about this public input that you're doing and the redesign. How has that worked out so far, and have you had some really interesting ideas from that?
We have had. Some of them, I can't say there's anything that has been a huge surprise, but it has been nice to see. We very much, since 2003, have really tried to focus on the general public as our primary audience for NASA.gov. There are obviously a whole lot of, like everybody else, there are a whole lot of different audiences that we could be interacting with. But we're focusing on the general public, and by general public, we envision people who do not have a sophisticated background in science and technology. At most, maybe they took a survey course as an undergraduate in astronomy or chemistry or something like that, but they don't make their living in science or in engineering. And so we're really focusing on them, but then we find is that the number one idea that it's been number one really since we opened the Idea Scale forum has been people want access to science data. That's something that's going to take a lot of exploring into what do people actually mean by that, because of course the raw science data is literally just ones and zeros. Do they mean the pictures that we get from the Hubble Space Telescope? Do they mean they would like access instantly to, say, global climate data? Or what we can provide with them on that front. But it's interesting to see, as we focus on this general audience, that actually they want access to science data. And then we've had a number of people who would like us to put more hard science in our stories, our feature stories, which we deliberately try to write for someone who maybe that general public audience that may not have that much of a sophisticated knowledge of science and technology.
Yeah, and Rafat was saying that he noticed last night you guys got hit really hard with traffic with the new images you had of kind of like the Earth at night.
Which we on a Skiff, which is a travel news site that we run, we used a couple of images just because they were amazing. Looking later in the night, we got some comments on our story saying that those images are not loading. So I was guessing, because these are heavy images, and it was, I guess you get hit hosting them.
We do, and that was unfortunate in that we, unfortunately, I didn't realize this, but the images were on the originating site called the Earth Observatory, which is one of our more popular sites, but
right,
their network,
yeah,
is institutional network at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. And so they were not in the NASA.gov infrastructure, which is in the Amazon cloud and is cached by Akamai and is more than capable of handling that level of traffic. And in fact, my team and the team at Goddard spent a good chunk of this morning pulling those images over into the infrastructure so that we could serve them more reliably.
So in doing your redesign, Brian, what other kinds of things are you guys thinking about doing outside of just the public input? I can imagine some design things you could do to kind of update it. Are you looking for more interactivity, more commenting, more ways to kind of include the public in things?
We are. We want some more dynamic presentations. We've gone to when we have major events like the Curiosity Landing on our site, we've gone to a more of a dynamic presentation where basically we're doing a splash page, but it's not just a flash graphic or anything like that. It's actually got the NASA TV feed embedded in it. It's got our Twitter feed embedded in it. We're taking public comments. And to really make it more of an event, one of the things we're really looking for is how do we integrate social media into our website. What I've found through the feedback that we get through the site is that we do have two different audiences. We have a social media audience and we have a web audience, and they only overlap a little bit. And so we want to be able to find a way to try to integrate that, those two audiences. Let the people who are on social media know that there is more content on the site. There is context and background if they want to explore it. And let the people who are coming to the website know that, you know, there's this whole conversation going on out there. There is a community of people who are talking about what NASA's doing and sharing it, and you might be interested in that. So that's one aspect that we're looking at as well.
And that sounds like something that almost every publisher thinks about. I mean, what I do at MediaShift, I'm always thinking about, there's these conversations going on social media, there's conversations going on a site, you know, how do you unify that? I mean, do you feel like, it seems like now you're almost like your own media outlet in a way. You don't necessarily have to go to the New York Times or Wall Street Journal or someone and say, hey, we've got this big news. You can literally just say, hey, we're going to put it out on our site. We have a huge audience. We don't necessarily have to worry about getting coverage.
Well, there's that's sort of an ideal case. And in all honesty, when a lot of us started really using the website for government communications, that was part of the point. It's like we don't have to go through the filters. We don't have to, you know, we don't have to try to convince a reporter to cover our story, and then he or she has to convince an editor to actually run it. We just say, here it is. And it was also, we're going to be able to give people more than they can normally get through those outlets. When Sojourner landed on Mars in 1997, you know, most of us, in the newspaper, you might get one or two pictures. Maybe you could wait for Time magazine to come out and there might be four or five really nice pictures. Or in 6 months, National Geo would do a huge spread on it. But now you got a website, we can post every picture up there. And that's what we found people really wanted. They didn't want just the one image they were going to see in the newspaper. They wanted to see everything.
Yeah, but I guess that makes sense. And that's what's so great about your website, is that people can really dig in, and whether, you know, they're really heavily science buffs or whether they're just kind of an average person who's really curious and loves those pictures. I mean, the images that you're getting, and it seems like the way that you guys are also kind of filtering the images, that seems to be what's really kind of changing lately, is that there's so many different ways of using kind of infrared and so many different ways of showing those images. The thing with the light from last night I thought was really amazing. I mean, there's just, it's not only are you getting these great pictures, but I guess the way that you're getting them and the way that you're filtering them looks even more interesting.
Right. And that's a tribute to the image processing team. And it's not just about how an image looks. It's about the data that you can convey through, you know, false color images, by measuring things in the infrared and then translating that into a visible image. And it's really nice when it overlaps. You've got a huge chunk of information in here for the technical community, and you've also got a great picture. If you look on our website now, we're highlighting an app that's come out called Earth as Art. It's just taking great looking Earth images. They may have some scientific value, they may not, but they just look fabulous.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate you joining us, Brian.
Sure thing. Glad to take the time.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank my co-host, Rafat Ali, as well as our guests, Matt Waite, Katie Culver, and Brian Duncan. We want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to keep up with all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idea Lab, at pbs.org/idealab and our new site, Collaboration Central, at collaborationcentral.org. We'll catch you next week.